From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. America is facing a new nuclear nightmare. We've heard of trouble in North Korea and Iran, but this one is right here at home. 2 years after 9/11, you'd think that weapons-grade plutonium stored in places like Los Alamos would be locked down and secure, but it isn't. And it could be the next target for terrorism. Tonight on Point, nuclear insecurity and the potentially catastrophic soft spot in Homeland Protection. We begin in Baghdad. American officials have gone on the offensive in hopes of quelling an Iraqi resistance that has intensified dramatically over the last few weeks. Dexter Filkins is a reporter for The New York Times in Baghdad. When I spoke with him earlier today, explosions were shaking Baghdad in the second night of what has been dubbed Operation Iron Hammer. I asked him to describe what was going on outside.
You can hear the boom, boom, boom of, I would guess that it's the same kind of gun that they used last night, which is a big artillery piece that's like a 105-millimeter gun that they mount on an airplane that they used to attack a building last night. And I would guess that they're probably doing the same thing tonight. It's the same thing we heard last night, just the boom, 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 and they're probably hitting a building somewhere.
Well, now, last night's airstrikes, as you know, were shortly after the truck bomb attack on the Italian military police compound in Nasiriyah. Was there a connection there, or was that timing simply coincidental?
I think it was coincidental. I mean, these things have been in the works for a while. They're not coincidental to the extent that the suicide bombing yesterday was more evidence of how intense and bloody the battle has gotten. And the Americans have decided that they've got to change their strategy and step up their own attacks to deal with them. So in that sense, it wasn't coincidental.
Dexter, if this is really all about the Americans regaining the initiative there, why bomb an empty warehouse as they did last night?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I ponder that myself. I went out there today. It's a warehouse. It's actually a factory. I mean, it was a textile factory. The machinery is still in there. The Americans said it was used as a place where, you know, bath party people and the like were meeting and planning attacks against them. An officer told me that they'd also fired some mortars from there. I suppose that's possible. I didn't get any sense of that when I was there, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. I thought what was strange was that the American soldiers went into the neighborhood beforehand and evacuated everyone and told them they were going to attack the place. They actually went to the building itself and told the guards to leave and told them we're going to bomb this place. So then, you know, they went and brought in one of these big airplanes and strafed the whole building. It's still there today. So, again, the purpose of the attack is kind of unclear.
Is there any danger that Operation Iron Hammer, as it's called, could backfire, particularly if there are civilian casualties? As you say, they tried to clear out the area beforehand this time, but, you know, who knows what could happen from here on in?
Well, there's absolutely a danger of that. I mean, I think it's the greatest difficulty in fighting a guerrilla war, which is you can't carpet bomb a town that's got a couple of guerrillas in it. I mean, that's the sort of fundamental dilemma that the Americans face. And you know, a lot of countries, I should say, if you want to take Russia in Chechnya, you know, they don't really take as much trouble to distinguish between civilians and combatants. And I think the Americans in the past 6 months have been very careful in trying to kill the bad guys and not hurt the good guys. Now, there's a lot of pressure on them to step up these attacks, and I think that you're going to find probably more civilians are going to get hurt in the coming days. I mean, that's a fact of life. An American officer told me as much a few days ago. He said, you know, there's going to be a lot of violence and innocent people are going to get hurt, and that's the way it is.
And these are tactics that have been used elsewhere by the Israeli military, for example. Do they have a record of success?
They do and they don't. I mean, if you want to take the case of Israel, they've got fantastic intelligence and capabilities. But I think even on those occasions when they do kill the people they want to kill, the conflict kind of rages on there seemingly without end. So they're facing the same problem here. The Americans feel like they've got to take the gloves off to tamp down this insurgency, but obviously they run the risk of alienating their supporters, and really the great majority of Iraqis are just kind of sitting on the fence.
The thought has also been expressed, Dexter, that we don't necessarily need more boots on the ground. We do need better intelligence. Any signs that that's starting to happen now?
I can't say that it is. What I see here is the same thing that I've seen in other places where the American military is engaged, which is that they've got fantastic technical capabilities. They can listen in on telephone conversations, and they can wiretap, and they can, you know, intercept emails and that kind of thing, which is often very effective. But what they lack, and you know, they'll tell you this themselves, what they lack is human intelligence. They just don't have enough people, you know, walking in the front door and saying, the bad guy lives down the street from me, here's his address. Nobody really knows why. I think the Americans like to think that the reason why more people aren't coming forward is because they're afraid. I think a more pessimistic assessment would be that, you know, they don't have as much support as they'd like.
As you get out and walk around among Iraqi civilians in the past 24 hours, Dexter, have you been able to get much of a sense from those people as to how they're viewing these airstrikes?
Well, I was in the neighborhood that was where the warehouse was that was attacked. But what I had really was a bunch of people kind of scratching their heads. They had been evacuated from their homes yesterday. The Americans came in and strafed that building, and now they're back. I talked to several people in the neighborhood today, and they all said pretty much the same thing, and it was kind of discouraging from the American standpoint. They said, we were happy when they came in here. They got rid of Saddam. But, you know, if things aren't working out, the neighborhood's not secure. There's too much violence. Things are out of control. We're not happy anymore. And I heard that from every person I talked to today.
Well, Dexter Filkins, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dexter Filkins is a reporter for the New York Times. He spoke with us from Baghdad. Imagine this scenario. A terrorist cell penetrates an American nuclear weapons facility. They break into the site, capture weapons-grade plutonium, and escape with little or no reaction from the facility's security forces. Impossible to imagine? Well, think again. That is exactly what has happened in repeated war games run by the Department of Energy. They've tested America's most sensitive nuclear weapons sites, places like the Los Alamos National Laboratory, where much of Americans' weapons-grade plutonium is processed. And security there has faltered, even totally failed to respond to these mock terrorist attacks. It is a disturbing weakness in American homeland defense, uncovered in the latest issue of Vanity Fair magazine. Tonight on Point, nuclear insecurity in post-9/11 America. So here's the question for you. Is the fear of a Los Alamos terrorist attack America's new nuclear nightmare? Is too much attention being placed on nuclear threats from Iran and North Korea when our own stockpile of plutonium is susceptible to attack? What will it take to make America's nuclear facilities truly secure? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us now from San Francisco is Mark Hertzgard. His story, Nuclear Insecurity, Exposed the Vulnerability of American Nuclear Facilities, and it appears in the November issue of Vanity Fair magazine. Welcome, Mark Hertzgard.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And also with us here in the studio is Jim Walsh. He is the executive director of the Managing the Atom Project at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. And welcome, Jim Walsh.
Good to be here, Gail.
Mark, I want to start with you because it would be helpful, I think, if you could give us a quick overview of some of the problems that you uncovered in your article, because it is quite a list. And quite frankly, I'm not sure which is more disturbing, the security lapses or the absolute indifference of the government, except when it comes to punishing the whistleblowers.
Yes, this story is based on two senior whistleblowers coming forward for the first time, speaking out publicly, and I must say very reluctantly. Both of these guys, Rich Lavernier and Chris Steele, are real straight arrows, many years of service to the government. They take security extremely seriously, and for that reason, they were alarmed by what they were seeing, not only at Los Alamos, but a lot of facilities around the country. Lavernier was essentially running the nuclear war games that the U.S. government regularly conducts in order to test for preparedness against terrorist attack. And he was finding that his so-called black hats, the commandos that he was sending on these mock terrorist raids, were getting in and defeating the security forces more than 50% of the time, even though the security forces knew months in advance exactly what day the attack was coming. And for trying to fix that problem, Lavernier was essentially taken off the job, and a similar thing happened to Chris Steele.
And how did you come across this information?
Well, I'm an investigative reporter, and I have done stories in the past with the lawyer who was representing these guys, and a third whistleblower in the story as well, about civilian airplanes. This is an outfit called the Government Accountability Project in Washington, and they're probably the premier whistleblower protection public interest group. And, you know, when the lawyer there, Tom Devine, told me about these guys and the difficulties that they were in, it just sounded like an amazing story.
Hmm. And Jim Walsh, what do you make of this? Is this a surprise?
Unfortunately, it's not a surprise. The 50% failure rate is roughly comparable to the failure rate for civilian nuclear power plants. That when the DOE, the Department of Energy, runs mock attacks on regular power plants, be it Seabrook or any power plant around the country, about half of them fail. So that wasn't surprising. And unfortunately, the sort of government impulse to clamp down or to sort of cover up that story, cover up perhaps is too strong a word, but certainly to suppress that story. Again, unfortunately, there's a long history of that because folks don't want to cause controversies. They don't want to have to answer difficult questions. But I do think we have to put it in perspective. So let me quickly say this. On the one hand, these plants are not plants and facilities, whether they be the labs where I used to work. I worked for 2 years at Livermore National Lab in Livermore, California, or whether they be civilian nuclear power plants, are not as secure as we would like. On the other hand, the defenders of those plants are right in saying they're more secure than other parts of the energy infrastructure, more secure than pipelines or more secure than chemical plants. So they're better than some parts, but they're not as good as they should be. And when you consider the consequences, certainly we need to pay more attention to it.
Well, and in fact, Mark, that brings up an interesting point because they certainly seem to be secure. When you went to Los Alamos, you were being checked every 20 seconds, it sounds like, by people who were saying, you know, move along, you don't belong here.
Yeah, I went out there as a reporter, and it does look impressive when you go through the normal drill. But, you know, I'm a reporter who's armed with a notebook and a couple of pens. And so to me, yeah, it looks impressive. But Rich Lavernier, my source, said, it's all smoke and mirrors. It looks very impressive out front with the razor wire and the guards and all that. But if you go around back, you see that the sensors don't work and the fence has a hole in it and so forth and so on. You know, Chris Steele, the second whistleblower, amazing story. He's the head of safety for DOE at Los Alamos. And he first got in trouble with his superiors when he discovered a secret nuclear waste dump inside of Los Alamos. He shut it down. And then a year later, he got in trouble again after September 11th when he said he was looking at one of their proposals for, you know, protecting against terrorist attack. And basically this report said, well, it's true that if an airliner were crashed into our main nuclear waste dump, it would set hundreds of thousands of gallons of nuclear waste on fire. But not to worry, because the fire would be put out by the sprinkler system. And Steele said to me, very dry wit kind of guy, he said, I said that must be some magical sprinkler system because it's able to rise up out of the rubble and turn itself on and put out this amazing inferno. We should get one of those for every nuclear plant in the country. But the government didn't appreciate his sense of humor, and literally a month later he was off the job. And by the way they do this is really despicable. They don't fire these guys outright because that would give them due process rights. Instead, they accuse them of passing classified information, and they take away their security clearance.
We're talking this hour about nuclear insecurity in America and the potentially catastrophic soft spot in U.S. homeland security. Is this the new nuclear nightmare? If places like the Los Alamos National Lab are vulnerable to terrorist attack, what will it take to shore up homeland security? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we'll be back in a moment. We'll be right back. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking this hour about an alarming soft spot in American homeland security, U.S. nuclear facilities that could be targets for terrorist attack. Has too much attention been placed on the potential threat from Iran and North Korea when our own nuclear materials are vulnerable to terrorist attack? And if nuclear facilities are already failing mock terrorist attacks, what's it going to take to shore up homeland security? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're joined this hour by Mark Hertzgard in San Francisco. He's the author of the article Nuclear Insecurity that appears in the November issue of Vanity Fair. And in the studio, Jim Walsh, who's director of the Managing the Atom Project at the Harvard University Kennedy School of Government. Mark, give us a little sense of what the larger implications are here of what you discovered. What are the worst-case scenarios, and particularly in terms of, if it's not an attack that can be protected against because it's somebody coming in not to remove material but on a suicide mission?
Yeah. Well, first let me say that not all of our weapons facilities are as vulnerable as Los Alamos. Mr. Walsh made this point before, and I think it deserves emphasis. There are some terrible vulnerabilities, but not everywhere. We have 10 major nuclear weapons facilities in this country, and Los Alamos is in big trouble. Oak Ridge in Tennessee is also, I'm told, quite vulnerable, but others are very well protected, such as the Pantex plant in Texas. And so that, I think, there's some lessons there as to how we can fix this. But in the places that are bad, the basic danger is that terrorists could get in and grab plutonium and go away and make a bomb that could be dropped on a major American city. So that, we're basically talking about a nuclear September 11th. And in this case, it wouldn't kill just 3,000 people. It could kill 300,000 people if it were dropped on Boston or Philadelphia or a place like that. So that's one possibility. The other possibility, as you mentioned, is that the terrorists could just decide to blow up the facility right there. Now, that would not create, in most cases, it would not be a Hiroshima-like explosion. What you'd have instead is a sort of what the experts call a plutonium fire, which wouldn't kill 300,000 people or anything like that, but it would certainly kill a lot of people in the immediate vicinity and render a lot of that land uninhabitable for quite a while. There'd be hundreds of cancer deaths and an enormous environmental catastrophe.
Jim Walsh, what about that point of if the terrorists are after plutonium, there are certainly some easier places to get it.
Yeah, first of all, let me say that I very much enjoyed Mark's article, and I recommend it to anyone who's interested in this. From my perspective, I think if a terrorist is interested in acquiring plutonium or highly enriched uranium, the two materials you need, you need one of the two to build a nuclear weapon, there are easier places to get it. You could get it. The best place would be the former Soviet Union. The Department of Energy estimates that there are 600 metric tons of nuclear material there, more than half of which is insecure, vulnerable to theft. So if I was a terrorist and I wanted to build a nuclear weapon, I would go there. But I think the scenario that Mark outlines, the second one, the happy scenario of an attack that releases radiological material, is in practice would be horrific. I chair a group at Harvard on radiological weapons, on a terrorist use of what would be called a dirty bomb, and this would be a very, very bad dirty bomb, and I think would shake the nation to the core. So the second described happy scenario is not a very good scenario, and I think actually that's the one that's more likely. I think if terrorists want a nuclear weapon, there are easier places for them to get the plutonium or the highly enriched uranium.
I think that's right, that is the easier and the more likely scenario. And it makes it all the more just unfathomable why the Department of Energy does not even test against that scenario. You know, Lavernier's black hats were defeating the security forces more than 50% of the time, and they weren't even allowed to do suicide tests. Now, obviously, it's a lot easier to win a suicide attack. If the kinds of tests that Lavernier's guys had to win, you had to get in, get the plutonium, and get away again. That's the hard part. But we don't even test for suicide attacks. So I think that the vulnerabilities are even larger in some ways than the numbers suggest.
And Mark, when these folks showed up to do the tests, to do the mock attacks, how did that work? I mean, did they burst in with guns and, you know, or did they just sort of show up and quietly infiltrate the place?
It depends. A lot of times the attacks are made at night, as a normal terrorist, if you will, a normal terrorist would do. Sometimes the Lavernier says that a lot of the times at Los Alamos, his black hats never even had to fire a shot because they never encountered any guards. Now, how, you ask, is that possible? One of the difficulties at Los Alamos is that they have an area called TA-18, Technical Area 18, where a major reactor is, that is, by the Department of Energy's own admission, quote-unquote, an indefensible site. And it's indefensible because that TA-18 is at the bottom of a canyon on the edge of the Los Alamos facility. It's surrounded on three sides by very steep, high, wooded ridges. And so one of the black hats that I talked to said, boy, my guys, as soon as they saw that terrain, they were licking their chops, because all you do is you get up there on top, you train your fire down into that canyon, and there's no way that the poor guys at the bottom can defend themselves. And as such, one time, to sort of add insult to injury, the black hats decided to get the plutonium and take it away in a Home Depot shopping cart, after which the Department of Energy complained and said, no, that doesn't count, because the Home Depot shopping cart was not on the list of approved equipment for these war games.
Jim, you're shaking your head. It does sound pretty ludicrous, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and you know, there are other issues here, and Mark has alluded to them. I mean, this is the best possible scenario for the defenders at the plant. They know in advance that a particular mock drill is going to happen on that day. You know, and if you know that and you still fail, that's not a good sign. But I think what Mark points to is really a piece, or he highlights a piece of what is a broader political problem here. He's really focusing on Los Alamos and other DOE facilities. There are civilian nuclear power plants here. But it's really part of the broader issue of how do we protect ourselves against a nuclear attack from terrorists? Whether they get the material abroad, whether they get the material here, it doesn't really matter. When the thing goes off, that's what we're concerned about. And I think the fundamental issue here is that we have put our political priority, our money, our attention, our efforts into other issues, into Iraq, in elsewhere, and not on this issue. We talk the talk. We say we're concerned about a WMD terrorist attack, but at the end of the day, we are not doing the things, not giving it the priority and spending the money in ways that would really make that the top priority, and that's what we should be doing.
No, and unfortunately, the Bush administration has been really pretty terrible on this. You mentioned earlier where most of the plutonium is in Russia, and that's certainly borne out by my previous reporting. I was the first Western reporter to get into Chelyabinsk, which was the center of the Russian nuclear weapons complex during the Cold War. And there's no security there. Now, there's a number of initiatives on the American side, former Senator Lugar and Senator Nunn behind this, to go into Russia and to basically secure this plutonium. And it doesn't take a lot of money, but the Bush administration, backed by some sort of far-right legislators in Congress, is balking on spending the money because of their fear that Russia could still become an enemy at some point, and we shouldn't be funding them to do this. This is crazy. We absolutely, our national security requires us to go into Russia and clamp down on that, on those sources of plutonium and highly enriched uranium, and we're simply not doing it.
Well, to that point, Mark, earlier today I spoke with Congressman Ed Markey, who is a Democrat from Massachusetts.
Sure.
He's senior member of the Energy and Commerce Committee and also the Select Committee on Homeland Security. And I asked him about the point you just made, whether Congress and the Bush administration are taking this issue seriously enough.
I do not. I think that Los Alamos is a good example of how the Bush administration nickel and dimes security at nuclear weapons facilities around our country. They continue to shoot the messenger instead of putting policies in place to shoot the terrorist, because obviously they don't want to spend the money.
So it's really all about money, or is it also about, you know, don't tell us about problems that we don't think we can fix?
Well, it's a matter of priorities. If they spent the money, they could solve this problem. But they have different priorities, and amongst them are tax breaks for the upper 1 or 2 percentile and spending $87 billion in Iraq. Those decisions affect other priorities, including security at nuclear weapons facilities. And as a consequence, we continue to have this regulatory black hole that makes it more attractive for terrorists to think that perhaps they can penetrate the security at these facilities.
You mentioned a moment ago about the messengers being shot because of the message they're delivering. Anything that Congress can do about that?
Well, I have added language to legislation which would protect whistleblowers at nuclear weapons facilities. And I actually have been able to get substantial Republican support for those protections. I'm hoping that they will be included in the final energy bill, which is coming out onto the floor of the House and Senate next week. So far, so good. It's something that many congressmen of both parties are very concerned about.
In the Vanity Fair article, there is a quote from a 1999 study that said, during the Clinton administration, described DOE as a very cynical agency, a place that really was basically unable to reform itself.
Mm-hmm.
So if it can't do that internally, can Congress do that?
Well, what we keep seeing over the years is the result of a departmental culture at the Department of Energy that puts weapons research and production first and safety second. It is a culture that seems to have an inverse system of punishments and rewards in which whistleblowers get retaliated against and the managers that engage in such retaliation get away with it. And so what we need to do is, from a congressional perspective, which I believe my amendments in this energy bill reflect, is have more congressional intrusion into the process in order to ensure that this executive branch agency doesn't continue on allowing these very dangerous counterproductive activities to continue.
Congressman, thank you so much.
Thanks, Gail.
Congressman Edward Markey represents Massachusetts' 7th District, and he spoke with us earlier today from Washington. So, Jim Walsh, let me put it to you. Here's a member of Congress saying, it's the Bush administration's fault. Is it fair to say if a Bush administration person were asked, they would say, no, it's Congress's fault? Does Congress have equal responsibility here?
Probably less so. Why do I say that? Because Congress has traditionally appropriated more money for what's called Nunn-Luk, or for these initiatives in the former Soviet Union to clean up and secure nuclear material than the president has requested. So that, and it's been of a bipartisan nature, because after all, Dick Lugar is a Republican. And when there was the Baker Report, you know, that's former Senate Majority Leader Baker, who was a Republican. So the Congress, and in particular the Senate, has been pretty good on these issues. If I was going to disagree with Congressman Markey, I would say, in some small way, it's the money is part of it, but that's not the real deal. The real deal here is the political priority, because there are bureaucratic issues. I mean, I have friends at DOE who work very hard, who care about these issues, who want to do a better job and are pushing to make it better. But DOE historically, not today, but historically, has been a problem department. I mean, scandals and all sorts of things in the nuclear area. And it's hard to turn a big department around. Even after 9/11, even 2 years later, it's tough to turn everything around. But what turns it around is not even the money, although more money would be good. It's political priority. It's the president going to President Putin and saying, this is important to us, and we're willing to cut a deal to make this happen. And that's what's lacking. There's the talk there, but not the political priority that would make things move down the chain of command and really happen in a more expedited manner.
And, Mark, I want to ask you also about another aspect of your article. You spoke with a gentleman named Bogdan Jakovich, if
yep.
I'm saying that properly.
Yep.
He found some huge lapses in airport security, including one instance when he and his team just walked through an alarm door and nothing happened.
Yeah, Bogdan Jakovich was essentially to airplanes what Rich Lavernia was to nuclear weapons facilities. That is, he ran mock terrorist attacks to try and see if you could get guns and bombs onto planes. And for the 5 years before September 11th, he and his team were getting guns and bombs onto planes 85% to 99% of the time out of airports like Logan, JFK, my own home airport, SFO, and above all, Washington, D.C. And it was in Washington, D.C., the story that you mentioned, where they decided one day they were getting so disgusted at how easy it was that they said, well, let's just try and walk through this alarmed door and see how long it takes for the security forces to come and find us. So they kick the alarm door open, and the alarm starts blaring, and they look down at their watches, and they start to time it, and a minute goes by, and 2 minutes go by, and 5 minutes go by, and the alarm is blaring. People are walking by with their bags and wondering what the heck is going on. After 15 minutes, the security forces had still not shown up.
It is amazing. And officials at the Transportation Security Administration, of course, now are saying that airports are more secure than ever. And anyone who's waited in a long line or had to take off their shoes can attest to the fact that there seems to be a much higher level of security checks. I can tell you they get me every single time the shoes come off. So what about this? I mean, is this all smoke and mirrors, too?
Well, Bogdan Jakovich would tell you it is. In fact, he says... Mainly that stuff about taking your shoes off and all these lines, he says that's theater. That's designed to make you passengers uncomfortable, and therefore you think that things are being taken care of. But the basic problems, according to Jakovich, have not really changed. And in fact, we saw just last month that 20-year-old kid got out of Baltimore, got a bunch of box cutters onto these planes. The basic underlying problems have not been fixed, and I think that is similar to the nuclear weapons problem, and it gets to something. It's not just what Congressman Markey said about money, although that's correct. Tom Devine, the lawyer for these guys, I think makes a very interesting point at the end of the article in Vanity Fair. He says, look, these problems existed under Clinton, too. Let's be clear about that. To be fair, both the nuclear weapons and the airports were unsafe under Clinton. But the difference is that Clinton's Secretary of Energy, Bill Richardson, was trying to change that entrenched culture there. It does take a long time, as Mr. Walsh said. But now we've got in office an administration, a right-wing Republican administration, that essentially doesn't believe in government in the first place. They think government's bad, the marketplace knows best, and government regulation should be limited. Well, these are problems of government regulation, regulating and making sure that the airplanes keep their planes safe and that the nuclear weapons facilities are properly managed. If you've got an administration in power that philosophically does not believe in government regulation in the first place, it's no surprise that they are not very interested in spending the time and the energy and the money needed to do this job right.
Well, we're speaking this hour about nuclear insecurity in America and the disturbing soft spot in U.S. homeland security. Are the whistleblowers in this story heroes, or are they crying wolf? And what should the Department of Energy and the Department of Homeland Security be doing to make nuclear sites more secure? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we'll be right back. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about a disturbing soft spot in American homeland security, U.S. nuclear facilities that could be targets for terrorist attacks. If half of America's nuclear facilities are failing mock terrorist attacks, what will it take to make them truly secure? Can these places be effectively defended? And if so, how? And are U.S. airports safer places now? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. And I'm joined this hour by Mark Hertzgard in San Francisco, who is the author of the article Nuclear Insecurity that appears in the November issue of Vanity Fair. And in the studio, Jim Walsh, director of the Managing the Atom Project at the Harvard University Kennedy School of Government. Jim, I want to give you a chance to speak to the issue of airport security as well, because there were certainly some disturbing findings in Mark's article.
And they were disturbing, and I think emblematic of the general problem. But, you know, TSA, Transportation Security Administration, has problems. Well, gee, there's a shocker, huh? You know, that they would have problems here. But I do want to say this, is that the core issue with respect to aviation was securing the cockpit. And I complained for months after 9/11 that they hadn't done it. I mean, we passed the Patriot Act, you know, 3 weeks after 9/11, but we couldn't secure the cockpit door. Now, that is done. And so I do think that's an improvement. There have been some improvements. Again, in some ways, it's not unlike the situation at the Department of Energy or elsewhere. There have been improvements made since 9/11. But the question is, are they where they need to be? Are we as safe? It's not, are we safer today than we were a year ago? It's are we as safe as we should be 2 years after 9/11? I think the answer is we're safer, but not as safe as we should be.
All right. Let's bring in one of our listeners to the conversation from Lexington, Kentucky. Bob's on the line. Hi, Bob. Welcome.
Hi. Enjoying the program and so forth. But get to the point. I wanted to bring out a recent incident that caught my attention, because back in the 70s even, I was actually with the military police at West Point, okay? And your callers probably realize there's some significance there, because right across the river is Indian Point. So when I hear stories about these lapses, I can't help but notice them. And I believe, I'll tell you, I have to confess, I heard this on Harry Scherer's show, but he was reading it verbatim from the newspaper, and this had to do with a recent lapse in the power system in California. I'm thinking San Bernardino Valley. And the gist of it, they raised the security level, and that prompted them to bring in the county sheriffs, all the off-duty sheriffs, or a good number of them, to cut to the chase here. Instead of going and doing what they were supposed to do, they just all brought their fishing gear to begin with and just fished. And they were told to, hey, start checking the grounds. And what this paper reported was that they called their off-duty friends, because I guess the fishing was real good that day. It was on some, perhaps near a dam or something, and they just told the regular security guard, don't bother our buddies, you know, just let them through. And this was worse than I ever had heard in the past. And I believe in following up on that, they also found, as per usual, 12 sets of master keys missing again.
Well, Bob, we appreciate the call. And actually, Mark, your article tells a similar story on Super Sunday, as I recall.
Yeah, Rich Lavernier. You know, these whistleblowers are, shall we say, pretty driven individuals usually. And Lavernier in particular used to mount these surprise spot checks on his workers. And so one Super Bowl Sunday, he went in, and this was at Rocky Flats, the facility outside of Denver. And went in, and he said that he was looking in patrols that you were supposed to see three times an hour. You didn't see him for 6 hours. And we went and looked, and sure enough, all the boys were inside watching the ball game.
And, Jim, you know, that's human frailty. I mean, you know, how do you protect yourself against something like that?
It is, but, you know, it's important to be alert on those times, because the terrorists, Al-Qaeda in particular, which focuses on training, but others as well, focus on opportunities. What is operationally the chance where they're going to have the greatest success? And we think back in history, think of the Yom Kippur War, the Ramadan War, that was launched against in 1973 because Egypt and Syria felt that would be the point at which Israel would leave its guard down. And they were correct, and they were able to take advantage of that. And terrorists think, not to link Egypt to Al-Qaeda, but that's the way the terrorists think. They're going to be looking for those soft points. I think one of the great lines in Mark's article was, you know, the folks at Los Alamos were complaining that, well, this is unfair what you're doing. You're attacking us when we least expect it, or you're using unfair advantages, as if the terrorists wouldn't do the same thing. So I think it's important. And that gets back to the issue of the safety and security culture. What is the culture at the labs? Now, I spent two years at a nuclear lab, Lawrence Livermore Lab in California, and they call it a campus. They want to make it, feel like a university campus where folks have a free exchange of ideas. I think that's great. That's what you want to have. But it's often these labs are isolated, and they're used to working in their own way, and they don't really take security seriously. DOE hadn't taken security seriously up until 9/11. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission hadn't taken it. You know, an interesting story. The day after 9/11, there was a hearing in South Carolina about whether to license a particular plant, a nuclear plant in South Carolina, and they allowed the license, and part of it was they thought that terrorist acts involving a nuclear facility do not fall within the realm of, quote, reasonably foreseeable events. It just takes a long time for this culture to really learn the lessons and to move, and I think it's a culture problem.
Mark, what do you think is going to be the outcome of your article? What response have you gotten so far, and do you think this really is a wake-up call that is being heard?
There's no doubt it's been heard in Washington. Unfortunately, the response has not been very good. The Department of Energy's official response essentially says it is two parts. We don't fail 50% of the tests, and two, even if we did fail 50% of the tests, that's actually a good thing because failure is how we learn. Now, that is the kind of answer that does not give you confidence that they're getting the point here. I'm glad to hear of Congressman Markey's efforts, and there's a number of other people in Washington who do want to do the right thing on this. I do know that 60 Minutes is planning a follow-up to our piece in Vanity Fair, and that, of course, will help increase the pressure on Washington. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's the Bush administration who's got to both spend the money and change the culture inside. And we keep coming back to that point. We have to realize the nuclear weapons complex in this country from the World War II forward has been a state inside of a state. It is not used to and it does not like having to take orders from civilians. And so that's really underneath what needs to happen. And I think that in that sense, the more public outrage there is about this, the more likely it is we're to see some much-needed reform.
All right, Mark. We'll be watching it, as I know you will. Thanks so much to Mark Hertzgard, who joined us from San Francisco. Thanks, Mark.
My pleasure.
He is an author and journalist. He wrote the article Nuclear Insecurity in November's issue of Vanity Fair. And also James Walsh, who's here in the studio with me. He's executive director of Managing the Atom Project at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Gail.
You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a radio diary from the mother of a soldier in Iraq. This is On Point. There was a second night of explosions in Baghdad tonight as U.S. soldiers continued Operation Iron Hammer, a new Get Tough campaign that began last night against the insurgency. Meanwhile, a series of raids in Iraq over the past 2 days has led to the arrest of 20 people now being held as enemy combatants. One of the soldiers charged with rooting out Iraqi insurgents is Private Roman Diaz of San Diego. Roman's mother, Sue, has heard only sparingly from her son since his unit moved into Iraq over the summer. But it was a phone conversation just before he moved north from Kuwait that she will never forget. In this radio diary, Sue Diaz recounts the phone call that transformed her relationship with her son.
I'm a writer. Putting words on paper is what I do. Ads, newsletters, a monthly humor column for a family magazine, an occasional opinion piece for the op-ed page of the local daily. But the words I'm looking at right now on the paper next to my laptop are unlike any I've ever written. The handwriting is mine. The paper's familiar, too, straight out of one of the letter-sized yellow legal pads I always keep handy on the desk here in my home office. But it's the words that are different. They're not mine. They belong to my son, Roman, a private in the infantry of the U.S. Army. Originally, Roman's after-high-school plan had been to make it on his own as a web designer. I don't want to go to college, he told me, his dad, and his sister, a Stanford sophomore, at least not right now. In the summer of 2002, Roman decided to join the Army, see the world, put college on hold even longer, and figure things out for himself in the meantime. He chose the Army partly because it offered him a say in where he'd be based. When he picked Germany, I was relieved. I thought for sure that he and his unit, the 1st Armored Division, wouldn't be involved in any conflict in the Middle East. But when bombs began falling in Baghdad, I've learned, all bets are off. He was in the Middle East the morning he called, the morning I wrote these words on this pale yellow paper. His unit had arrived in the desert staging area of Kuwait a week earlier, just after Baghdad fell. We'll be leaving here soon. We're already packed, so this will be my last call for a while, he said. There are no phones where we're going, no internet either. And where's that? I asked. Can't say. It's a secret, he answered, continuing with a laugh. Come on now, Mom. If I told you, I'd have to kill you. With some coaxing, I did learn that he and the rest of the men of Bravo Company would reach their ultimate destination 15 hours or so after their convoy headed north. Does the place start with a B? I pressed. Mom, he answered with feigned exasperation. During his years as a teenager, I'd often heard the real thing. Back then, it had been my job to ask the questions. Homework finished? What time does the movie end? Who's driving? And it was his job, or so it seemed, to answer with as few syllables as possible. But the day Roman called, he wanted to talk. Is Dad there? He asked. No, he's at a biotech conference today. Several months ago, my husband was laid off from his job as director of engineering at the big computer company where he'd worked for 27 years. He's been looking for work since then, and dreaming, too, of starting a company that develops software for the biotech industry. Dad's not there. Shoot, Roman said, adding in a voice that trailed off. There's something I really need to talk to him about. Can I help? I asked. No answer. Roman? Well, okay, I guess so. He sighed from half a world away. I waited for the rest and wondered what it could be. Got a pen, Mom? Yes. And a piece of paper? With each question, his voice gained authority. Then he told me what he hadn't wanted to tell me, how he'd taken out a life insurance policy for $275,000, the maximum the Army offers. Now, if anything happens to me, here's what I want done with that money. I jumped in to stop that kind of talk. What mother wouldn't? Don't be silly, I sputtered. Nothing's going to happen to you. You'll stay safe, and when you come home, you'll have lots of stories to tell. Someday your grandchildren will ask about the time... He cut me off. Mom, please, just write this down. And so, cradling the phone between cheek and shoulder, I took my son's dictation, writing first a few words about his big sister, pay for Anne's college, then a line about taking care of me, and finally, a phrase for his father, help Dad start his company. Did you get all that? He asked. Yes, I whispered. We chatted a few minutes more. Maybe it was about the weather, or the food, or the fellas he now hangs out with. I don't remember. My mind was still reeling with a changed reality, my heart twitching with a strange new sadness and a growing pride. When I'd answered the phone that day, I heard the voice of the boy I used to remind to eat his vegetables and pick up his socks, the same kid who balked at wearing a bike helmet, the teenager who played his hard rock CDs way too loud. I said, "Hi, Roman," to all those guys. But it was a man I said goodbye to.
Sue Diaz is a writer living in San Diego, California. Her son, Roman, is an Army private currently serving in Iraq. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.